Welcome to the Everyone's a Critic Movie Review Podcast. I'm your co-host, Bob Zarrell.
I mean, who wants to have sex with a guy named Bob?
Oh, Bob. Just doesn't sound right. Oh, Bob.
Bob.
Oh, Bob.
Oh, Bob.
Bob.
Oh,
Bob.
Bob. Bob.
With me, as always, is professional film critic Sean Patrick.
I am the smart. S-M-R-T. I mean, S-M-A-R-R-T.
And Josh Adams.
That's Jaime. Protege of mine. Ranked number 32 in the federal prison system.
32?
That's right.
Out of what, 20?
Visit us at IHateCritics.net, Everyone's a Critic Podcast.com, IHateCritics.com. We're on Facebook. We have a Facebook group as well. Our Twitter and Instagram handle is Critics Pod. Follow us there, like us there, friend us, whatever social media outlet you can. Our trailers are there, top fives, random news, Sean's reviews, interactions. But please like us there and help us grow the podcast. And then, of course, tell your friends about the show. And if you really want to support the show, ihatecritics.net/Patreon. It's the best way to support the podcast. I have everything almost in a box. I have them separated out. I have your names written on them. So I know I said 2 weeks ago they're going out that week. It's coming, though, I promise.
Yes, and Sarah, you'll be getting your stuff this week, too. I have graduated to a box as well in the front seat of my car. So, yeah, we're already mobile.
Yeah.
I've been to the post office with the crap in the front seat, forgot it, and still haven't done it yet.
It's almost the 1860s for you guys.
Yeah. At this point, if we had hired a pony, it would be there by now.
You know, stamps.com would be a sponsor. Yes. Sponsor every other damn podcast out there.
I'll sell damn stamps.
But I did go, I mean, for some of you, some of the higher levels, I got this Mandy box thing, so I'm going to include some like temporary tattoos and stickers and buttons and even a little mini poster for those as well. Feel free to discard them, but a little extra for some of the Patreon supporters. But yeah, ihatecritics.net/Patreon to get a credit on the show and help us grow. What am I forgetting? I think, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify. Listen to us to wherever you listen to us. Again, share with your friends and subscribe to the show wherever you listen to us, and then give us a review. If we have a review, I'll read it on the air. Mainly just Apple Podcasts, but if you send it elsewhere, let me know. Let's get to our show. We'll start with kind of news, I guess. It's more bad journalism, in my opinion, but Josh, you're the one who posted it.
I did. It was an article regarding Natalie Portman discussing her role as the manic pixie dream girl type of character. And there's a couple movies that come to mind. Beautiful Girls when she was, I think, 15 years old. And Garden State back in 2004. At least the article brings up Garden State for sure. And her sentence does not name either of those films, but it states that she regrets her role as the manic pixie dream girl, or whatever part she played in making that a thing, and being there mainly to serve as the completion to a male's journey. Now, I'm sensitive to that idea. I really am. I would like to be taught, if I don't already know that perspective. But from the point of view of the article, it makes it seem like she regrets those movies in general.
Specifically,
and I think
Garden
very unfortunate.
State.
Yes.
He really, and maybe, I mean, I get it. She also had said recently that she never had any female friends in the industry because she's the only girl on set a lot of times. And that, I think that's more everything, you know, everything she's done up until recently. And I it makes sense. And you are seeing that tide turn. But to pick out one specific movie that she had nothing to do with, it, to me, is just trying to get people in an uproar.
About Garden State, too, I've seen that movie since I saw it as two characters coming together and not necessarily just Zach Braff's character realizing something. She helps, but he was trying to figure something out before he ever met her. She helped him see himself, but she's also struggling with things too, and he kind of helps her come out of her shell a little bit. So to specifically state, as the article did, that he's only using the Natalie Portman character, just it hurts a little bit as a lover of that movie. And I would love to be taught if it's not the case, but I just don't feel that that's accurate.
And even if it is accurate, it's not so much bad towards that movie. It's just that there's not enough movies from the other side. You know, it's
agreed.
That's more of what the issue is, more so than Garden State being a problem.
It's a perception issue. When you're talking about a movie that was written and directed and starring one guy, and then he has a character in that movie who's an attractive girl who seems to meet all the needs, again, surface level. I'm not going into the depth on it, because I love that movie as much as you do.
Yeah.
But on a surface level, there's certainly a point to be made there that she could be a character that is functional to his journey, just based on the fact that he created her. So that's right. Not an unfair reading of it.
Right, but I do think it's more of the fact that you don't see that from the female. A lot of times you don't get a lot of, there's not a lot of ladybirds back then, you know? And that's kind of, I guess, more the problem than that movie by itself.
For sure. As we are continuing the outward and public outing of a lot of people doing the wrong types of things, and I'm including this story in on that to get a broader idea of how we're progressing. And this is just a piece of that puzzle. And this one was kind of like a, ooh, I don't know. I agree with a lot of things that have been said. Absolutely, of course. And this one, I turned my stomach a little bit. That's all.
Yeah, we should rename the show Mansplaining. We should have done that.
I am afraid, with the good intentions that I have of saying anything wrong, but I'm just going to continue to try and be honest and say that I can make mistakes.
We've avoided a lot of things just because it's really not for us. It's more for us to listen and then to talk about it.
That's a good way of saying
and
it.
And I think this is separate. I think it's, you know, kind of more specific thing that I think is more bad journalism than anything. But that's just me. Three trailers. Let's start with Spies in Disguise.
What a shitty trailer.
You posted it. I was going to go trailer free this week.
Will Smith, I guess, is playing a character that seems like he might be out of the Despicable Me universe, maybe. Kind of seemed like that.
Yeah.
Kind of the similar animation. He gets turned into a pigeon for some reason. I don't know what's going on with that. It's really stupid.
Yeah. Will Smith and Tom Holland are the lead voices. Tom Holland is playing something of the Q character from Bond films. Will Smith is playing the typical Bond type spy. Next, I mean, Fishing with Gandhi, please. Yeah. Despite their talent, and it could be good. Ooh, bad trailer. Of your concepts, let's turn you into a bird. What does that do for you? It doesn't do anything for me. Maybe it does for smaller kids.
He's going to go on a journey of self-discovery and discovery that, you know, that there are other people with other perspectives. And, oh my God, kill me.
Birds of a feather may flock together in this film.
It's a better title.
I can't believe I said that. I won't
think of that. I don't know. I can see this being a movie my son watches repeatedly. Right now what he does is he just re-watches movies all the time. And they're like not new. Like right now, it's Sing. Like he, you know, he watched it once and it went away. You know, Moana, he just stopped doing that with, and then Peter Rabbit, he was doing it with for a while.
6 years old.
Yeah,
yeah. My version of that was a teen beach movie for some time, and the self-flagellation was continuous during that time.
My daughter was. Like three was High School Musical 3 because of my sister, and that was rough.
I just throw out some sympathy from Melissa. Her 6 year old, my goddaughter, is still unfrozen. Still,
let it go.
Yeah, that fine movie that really got ruined by repeat viewings. Specifically that song. Like even Pearl Jam played the song in concert. That's how pathetic. 5 feet apart.
So they're remaking that movie already?
The remake
the
it
John
year.
Green movie? What was that?
Fault in Our Stars?
Are they remaking Fault in Our Stars already?
Well, I thought it was the one where the girl couldn't leave her house.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they remake this movie every year.
That concept, I guess, maybe. Two people with the same disease can't get within 5 feet of each other without giving each other their disease, and they need to stay 5 feet apart.
Six
feet apart to carry on their love story. But I gotta say, I do love Haley Lou Richardson. She's an incredible young actress. It's a shame to see her in such a obviously manufactured role as this.
I recognize the name, Cole Sprouse or Dylan
Full
Sprouse.
House.
Oh, really? Okay, well, that's not what I'm remembering him from. It's
the Nickelodeon series, right? He was on a Nickelodeon series with his twin brother?
Oh, I guess that happened, too. I'm thinking he was one of the... he played Ben on Friends, Ross's son. The twins did, I should right. say. So that's what I remember the name from, is Friends credits, not any of those things. But I was like, oh, he's all grown up now. I feel quite old, but this is a trailer. We've seen it lots of times before, and your words of pretty cancer come to mind. Instead, this time it's pretty cystic fibrosis. I don't know. Maybe that's not fair.
It doesn't roll off the tongue like
that. It doesn't.
Yeah, it's, again, I think we've seen a version of this movie every year for the past 3 or 4 years. Whether they're in space and not being able to...
Yes, the space between us. There you go.
It's all something, kind of.
Fibrosis. How about that? Instead of fibrosis? Yeah, yeah.
But you know what? At least some working actors are getting paid, and that's all I can really... I imagine it'll be successful, and they'll get a little money, and then they can do something good again.
Here's hoping. She was in Columbus. She was really great in that film, and she deserves better than this.
You know, it's the, was it the Matt Damon philosophy? One for them, one for me. Or who came up with that?
You. That's the first time I heard it.
I've heard them say that in like Kevin Smith commentaries and stuff like that. I think they even say it in Jay and the Silent Bob Strike Back when they're fighting over Good Will Hunting too. Isn't it romantic?
Yes, this is the Rebel Wilson movie where she hits her head and she ends up in a romantic comedy universe. I kind of laughed at this trailer, and kind of in spite of myself, even though I think that it's kind of hacky. I did laugh as she repeatedly tried to have sex with Liam. What's his name?
Hemsworth.
Yeah, that's him.
I don't really necessarily care about being trapped in a romantic comedy. Being trapped in a PG-13 movie would suck. If life was PG-13 all the time. All you can like see is a butt.
dry humping.
Yeah, and Rebel Wilson is kind of perfect for that idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, you say this is the most enjoyable of these three trailers by a mile. Mm-hmm. And I like Rebel Wilson. I don't like Pitch Perfect at all, but I mean, I like her to an extent.
I can see this movie shocking us and being surprisingly watchable.
Yeah, I definitely have a soft spot for Rebel Wilson and for Pitch Perfect, so I'm okay with this, even though it does seem kind of hacky.
But it is, I don't want to call it original, because it's not original, but it's somewhat original compared to what's, like, the other two we just saw.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, did you not start thinking of I Feel Pretty? Just a little bit.
Absolutely.
I did, but as soon as they said trapped in a romantic comedy, I haven't seen I Feel Pretty, but I do know the premise. But as soon as they said trapped in a romantic comedy, I kind of let that go and let this be its own thing. But I suppose you get a point. All right, let's get to our movies this week. We'll start with the second most successful movie, The Nutcracker and the Four Realms.
Yes, this is the a Disney movie. Lasse Hallström and Joe Johnston co-directing this film about a young girl named Clara, played by Mackenzie Foy, who gets a present from her late mother on Christmas Eve. It's an egg. It has a keyhole in it, but she doesn't have the key. But she does have a note with it that says the all you need is inside. She goes to this party thrown by her godfather, Mr. Drosselmeyer, played by Morgan Freeman, who has the key, and he sends it on this string, and she's got to chase it down, and it leads her to this place called the Four Realms, where she meets up with a nutcracker and goes on an adventure where she loses the key, but then has to get it back from Mother Ginger, played by Helen Mirren. There's also the other three realms are ruled by, she rules one realm. There are other three realms run by Richard E. Grant, Eugenio Derbez, and Keira Knightley as Sugar Plum. And the story will evolve from there, but this is not a particularly smart movie. What it is a kid's film, and I guess if you can put yourself in the mindset that they're talking to children, they're not talking to adults. You can kind of get around a lot of the problematic elements of this, which come from the fact that this is a really dumb movie. If you can't already guess what's inside that egg, it's a mirror. If that does not make you groan, I don't know how many... You must never have seen a movie before. She opens the egg, and it's a mirror, and all you need is inside yourself.
Oh,
now I get it. I thought it was yolk.
Well, I was confusing Disney stories. Like, is this the mirror that tells her she's pretty or something? I don't know.
All she needs is inside herself.
Oh, boy.
Now, if you've never seen a movie before, that's actually rather insightful and self-empowering. If you've ever seen a movie before, you're going, oh my God, that's so trite.
Yeah, I mean, but like you said, I can see parents and kids enjoying something like that. And
I can see kids.
Well, but certain
parents are going to be rolling their eyes if they have any intelligence.
Okay. I guess that's my point, whether I was going to be as mean about it, but... But I know parents like that.
Did you see that, honey? Everything you need is inside of you.
I'm not sure they would have actually picked up on that. They might have to have the mirror thing explained to them by their kids. I don't have anybody specific in mind when I'm saying this, so if you do listen and you think I'm talking about you, I'm not.
Bob is vague booking on our podcast.
It's a lovely looking movie, so that too, the kids will be enjoying all the bright, pretty colors and whatnot. But of course, to me, it just looked like another Alice in Wonderland, which just kind of hurt my head a good deal. But I got past it. Again, I know children will watch this and love the pretty colors. So it's probably, I guess, it's the least unwatchable thing I saw this weekend.
Oh, this is going to be fun.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody's fool.
Nobody's fool, yes. The interesting aspect of this is how little they've played up the fact that Tyler Perry is the director of this movie. Tyler Perry directs with Tiffany Haddish and Tika Sumpter. And you think from the trailer, right, that this is Tiffany Haddish in a starring role, right? Wrong. Not true. That is not true. Tiffany Haddish is not the star of this movie. She is a side character in this movie. She's essentially playing Madea without Madea being in the movie. She says all the wild and crazy shit that Madea usually says in a Madea movie. And then that's pretty much her function, is to do that. Tika Sumpter is the actual star here, is a character who basically has a boyfriend who is invisible. She never gets to see him. She talks to him on the phone. Her sister, played by Tiffany Haddish, just gets out of jail. She finds out about the invisible boyfriend and says, he's catfishing you. So she literally calls in the guys from Catfish to be in the movie, and they actually show up to look into this guy, and they find out that perhaps he doesn't exist. Meanwhile, she's also being romanced by a guy at a coffee shop, played by Omari Hardwick, who has a real thing for her and gives her sister a job, and they do try and have a relationship, but then something happens that would be a spoiler if I told you and throws the whole thing out of whack. The bottom line is, this is a terrible movie. It's not very funny. Tiffany Haddish tries, but Tyler Perry's got her firmly trapped in that Madea box where she's just having to say outrageous shit and then walk off the scene. There's a lot that happens in this movie that's very bad, and it's just this kind of typically lazy, unfunny shit that Tyler Perry's just gotten used to.
Is this another case of she wasn't quite a star when they started making it, and then they, I don't know.
Either that, or maybe she just, like, there's a lot of people who really admire Tyler Perry just for being successful, and, you know, Oprah works with him, so, you know, he's got that imprimatur going for him. So I think he can get just about anybody to do anything for him. So whether or not that's the case with Tiffany Haddish, I don't know. But whether or not she made this before she became a big star, I have no idea. But the bottom line is that there's a lot of bait and switch going on here with them trying to tell us that she's the star of this movie, and she is not. But if you're interested to know how this movie ends, it's very instructive of the failure.
Mirror?
I'm sorry?
Does it involve a mirror?
No, it does not. No, a mirror might have helped from the perspective, but no. I wrote a piece. It's in the I Hate Critics group about the ending of this movie and the failure of Tyler Perry in film language.
I read it. I knew it didn't involve a mirror. But...
Without spoiling, what'd you think?
I mean, I don't. Without spoiling, what did I think? I don't know. I go in and out of these kicks of, like, I feel like sometimes I don't want to, like, I don't like when people talk down to other people. And I wasn't saying that you were, but specifically, you posted a video in our group chat of this YouTube guy who was just kind of really talking down to the audience that, you know, and that part of that, I guess I was still in that mindset. And I was like, oh, some people are just, people can watch movies however they want. Kind of where I was at with it. Which is kind of where we're probably going to go with the next movie, too. But it does involve mirrors, at least a little bit.
With coke on them.
Yes, cocaine is on the mirrors. Thanks for explaining my joke.
Well, I need the explanation, so please, continue.
Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yes, Bohemian Rhapsody. This is the story of Freddie Mercury and Queen. Rami Malek plays Freddie Mercury. Charts their journey basically from the founding of the band through their successful Live Aid performance in 1985. And it's, to me, I just don't think this is a very good movie. What bothered me about it was first just some basic shit. Like I was talking before about film language. There's a couple of things where this movie comes up short on that. There's a scene that really pissed me off where Freddie walks into a scene where he's not been in the scene before. Queen is sitting around. They're just about to record the album, Night at the Opera. The rest of the band is in the cabin. They're arguing with each other over breakfast. And Freddie walks in, and among the first things he says in the scene is he points to Roger Taylor and he said, "There's only room in this band for one hysterical queen." And then he walks off. And it's such a bullshit trailer line because he has absolutely no context to say this at this point. First of all, he's not even come out as a gay man at this point, even though it's pretty obvious. He's also, you know, they've not established any of that in their dialogue, that he's sees himself this way, that they have this kind of interaction. You could assume it from what we know of Queen, but if you don't know anything about Queen, he's just a guy who walked into a scene and proclaimed himself a hysterical queen, and then walked off. And it's such a bullshit trailer line, but that's one of the minor aspects of this. There's other stuff, like the Top of the Pop scene, where they perform on television for the very first time, is the most unnecessary scene in any movie this year. Why does this scene exist? Give me a reason why the scene is there, because they walk in, they're going to perform on Top of the Pops, and they have this sort of disillusioning moment where they're told that they're not going to be able to perform live, that they're going to have to just fake it. And you think this is building towards something that's going to show us something about Queen. Well, no, they just go on and they do as they're told and the scene is over. It's completely pointless. It could be lifted from the movie. And there was this critic for Pitchfork who wrote a very interesting thing. She wrote that this is basically, this movie comes down to the Wikipedia version of Queen's life. And that's kind of reasonable, yeah. Because basically that's what the Top of the Pops thing is. It's just, here's the first time Queen was on television. Okay, next thing. Like, this is such a, I mean, I just, that whole thing just bothered me. But then, I don't really get the whole point of even making this movie, because it's clear that I don't think that these people even like Freddie Mercury, who made this movie. I mean, because every aspect of his life, they treat it like it's, his life was just endlessly lonely and miserable. That's all he ever was. He was just lonely and miserable his entire life. Here, enjoy Queen. Like, fuck you, give me a soundtrack then, I'm just gonna go home. Even if he was truly in his real life constantly miserable, I don't want to watch that movie. I don't want to watch my rock god be completely miserable for 2 hours. This is an unpleasant movie outside of the times when they're performing, because the music is incredible. And the performance scenes, Rami Malek is amazing. in these. And he's amazing even outside of those scenes, even in the bad scenes where he's forced to try and say some of the worst dialogue in any movie this year. He's good at, you know, he's really committed to it, and I appreciate all of his hard work. It's just a shame he has no control over the edit, which basically means that his character, Freddie Mercury, is treated as if his life is just nonstop misery. He's just alone, and he's manipulated by everybody. He has no agency. He has no opinions of his own that don't lead him down a dark path that takes him to just awful things. And, well, it's, Freddie, you did it to yourself. You know, it's so bad. This movie is just, it's so almost unwatchably dreary, really, at times when it's dealing with his life. And I just, I refuse to believe that Freddie Mercury's life was just nothing but endless dreariness. I don't buy that. But that's another aspect. But I just don't understand why anybody would want to watch a movie that portrays his life as just endlessly dreary.
This is like First Man backwards. He doesn't want his life, rock god. No, he wasn't Neil Armstrong and made a point that he did. People didn't want their heroes to have flaws or whatever.
But this isn't flaws. It's his life had no joy. There was nothing joyous off stage.
I disagree with that takeaway from the movie. There was definitely a segment where he went down a dark hole, but I only found that to be a segment of the movie. And you are right, this is Wikipedia version of Queen, but that's almost all of these are Wikipedia. Straight Outta Compton was a Wikipedia version of NWA, and my big problem with that was the same kind of thing. It was just you just moved along too fast. But I don't know. Josh, you want to start or you want me to just keep going?
Well, I think it's good that you began. I do think that the main point of my thought, and you may agree with me because I briefly discussed it with you, but it's really because you guys are music guys and I want to know your opinions beforehand. I didn't do what you said. I read your article before I saw the movie.
I did not.
And I read many critic reviews, actually 7 different critic reviews. They were all very negative, including the one from Pitchfork that you were talking about, that specific scene. What I came away with was a general idea that, including yourself, the ones that saw the film are fans of Queen. And so therefore there was an expectation of hope that you would portray Queen in the way that you expected Queen to be portrayed. And unfortunately, none of these musical biopics can incorporate every single little thing in it, so someone's going to be disappointed. And being a Wikipedia version of it, yeah. Thank you for saying what you said, because I was going to say it seems like all of these are really Wikipedia versions of things. We'll talk about a movie is our classic that is a bit more Wikipedia, but also it's going through the stanzas of somebody's life. It's basically the story of something has to follow that because it happened, I guess. It depends on how you edit it as to how much power you get out of that. And for me, I was not a huge Queen fan. My intro to Queen comes from 7th grade basketball. We started playing We Will Rock You before the games and whatnot, and then Wayne's World happened to come out, and then I have the greatest hits. Okay, well, that's how I was intro to many rock bands, but the greatest hits had We Will Rock You, We Are the Champions, Another One Bites the Dust, and then I got to the Bicycle Race song and said, oh, I'm checking out. I mean, because I really dislike that song. It just annoys me, okay? But I never continued because I was like, oh, well, it sounds like they've got 4 good songs. I don't need to listen anymore. I'm very wrong, okay? I listened to probably 60, 70 Queen tracks this week. I'm like, oh, they did that one? Oh, they did that one? It was a nice musical discovery for me this week. Thus, the movie fits what I wanted to see out of a movie. The movie itself has some flaws. I'm not going to debate you on that one, especially the Live Aid scene where you're focusing on people's reactions off stage and whatnot. It's like, they're smiling still. Okay, well, thanks. We can go back to Rami Malek now, and that would be fine. It's a little awkward there towards the end. But I really enjoyed it. And it's his performance. It's the camaraderie that the group seemed to have in the film. I can't relate this on anything that I know because I didn't know anything. So this is like an intro to deeper ideas about Queen for me. The music is very, very good in the film. I'm watching it also from the mindset of I took my son to see this and he wanted to see it. I was surprised that he wanted to see it. I'm like, you know who Queen is? He's like, yeah, of course I do. He's starting to play the drums in band right now. He's getting into a lot of really good music on his own, which is great. And Queen is one of them. And I thought this movie was going to end up being rated R. It's not. And it, I suppose they could have made it slightly more dreary or more graphic or whatever the case may be. But I don't think that we're going to learn anything more from that happening. If they put something different in this movie, what else would we learn? That's what I'm asking the critics to tell me. What else are we going to learn? Because as it is, I found it to be very enjoyable. It, your point about in your review about Mike Myers, it's well taken if you're a critic, because you guys are tired of seeing stuff like that in movies, I would imagine. Little like, it's a nod to that, it's a joke, blah, blah, blah. Mike Myers is playing the guy that rejects it. Oh, he played Wayne from Wayne. Okay, I get it. Because you're probably tired of seeing little gimmicks like that in films, maybe. But for me, I'm like, ha! It's Mike Myers. Aha, that's kind of cool. The crowd is enjoying the shit out of it. They're clapping. They're saying like, oh, yeah, he's in laughing at the scene because they know that it's Mike Myers. I think people in the crowd all over the place know who he was. Most of them were around my age or so. Ultimately, what it comes down to is I feel like critics in general are seeing this movie from one side and I'm seeing it from a completely different side, and thus I'm experiencing a different movie altogether than all of the reviews that I read, and I don't have a problem with it at all. The other critic from the Pitchfork article mentioned something about limiting Rami Malek to being gay by force in a way, okay? And I'm seeing it as he's more complex than that, and it's a delicate area here where I don't want to say what the critics are thinking, but it seems like we're placing that on the film because he's not what they wanted to see. I felt, as since it's my intro to Freddy's life story or whatnot, I felt that he was going on a journey and he hit some dark places. He made some wrong decisions, but also he seemed to have joy in this movie to me. Every time he was on stage,
I've given you that.
I see joy in his life. Mary brings him joy. I think that we see his upbringing just a little bit to show you the struggle that he had to deal with, and he's constantly struggling with himself and who he is and whatnot. That makes sense that he might struggle on a daily basis. That makes sense as to why he let himself into some dark places, why he had some strife with his bandmates or whatnot. There's a lot that we could probably go into, but I would like you to take over now.
Well, I mean, I guess I get the argument, why does this movie exist? Because I don't think there's anything to learn from this. Freddie Mercury is a very private person. A lot of the stuff was more rumors. A lot of rock bands back then. Part of the cool thing about them was the mystery behind them. And so you're taking that mystery and throwing it into this movie and trying to make something happen that may or may not have happened. It's definitely not historically accurate. But the stuff that it looked like The Disaster Artist, for example, that didn't follow the book, but it moved stuff around so that you still got the same tone and feeling of what really happened. You know, he didn't do his two solo albums before Live Aid. He did it like, I think he had one right before and then one right after, but they never broke up. There wasn't, a lot of that stuff has been added on for the movie, but there probably was band strife. They did start all writing after Live Aid, they did start sharing credits. There was things in there that existed, and he definitely went down a dark hole. I mean, dark rabbit hole in life, it was, you don't really know exactly what, because he never went and talked about it. But that scene where they were being interviewed and everyone talked to him about being his sexuality and whatnot, that was real. That kind of stuff they had to deal with all the time. So I don't know. I appreciated the fact that it had all that. But at the same time, you're not really learning anything because you're kind of using rumor and stuff to get there. But there's one thing I like a lot about this movie, which no other rock movie really has. Even I mean, I guess almost famous as it to an extent, but the band never gets credit, ever. It's always the main guy. And Brian May is my favorite member of Queen. You know, I mean, I might be a minority, and I definitely am, but there's definitely, he's probably everybody's second favorite, or a lot of guitar players' favorite. They get a lot of credit in this movie. He goes off and does a solo project, and it's not nearly as successful as Queen was. And, you know, obviously this isn't true. I mean, in real life, it wasn't successful either, but it was critically successful. But it was nice to have that conversation where, without you, I'm not the same guy. And it's true. The band without, you know, it's not Freddie Mercury. It's that band. It's all of them together making those sounds. And they really, I thought, captured that in this movie. And again, that's not important, but that doesn't add to the story anything. That's just something that I always bring to these rock movies, and it frustrates me when it's just one guy. So I appreciated that about this. But more than anything, like that Top of the Pop scene, it really just leads into a Killer Queen medley, or, you know, kind of montage, which all their songs are montages, so it didn't bother me. It was their first live performance. It was 30 seconds of something happened, and they went on and just showed this montage of Killer Queen. They did that a lot with every song, really. So is the whole thing unnecessary? Sure, I guess. But it was, and to be honest, I don't want to see a Led Zeppelin movie. I don't want to see an Aerosmith movie. I don't really, I'm more into those bands than Queen. I do like Queen a lot, but it's so hard to capture everything and then make it accurate and fun and everything. And it kind of came down to I did have fun with this, and really the only part where I found him to be miserable was that, you know, right before Live Aid part where he kind of quit the band or took a break and made money. Otherwise, I didn't really find misery. And he was moving forward the whole time. That was kind of his main thing, is always moving forward. He never took time to enjoy the moment. And you see that a lot with people who are successful, and especially when you become a rock god, it's pretty lonely lifestyle, and I thought that actually captured this pretty good. But it does humanize a rock god, and people don't like to see that.
It's not anything I brought to the movie. This is a badly made movie, is my point. I mean, we start with Somebody to Love, which they play, and I mean, it's like listening to fucking McKee writing a screenwriting book. We'll find that song that kind of sort of maybe reflects his life. Somebody to Love. He never had somebody to love. Brilliant. Never mind that song doesn't mean anything related to this journey, but nevertheless, we'll just throw that on the front and everybody can go, aha, see, this is a journey about Freddie trying to find somebody to love. This bullshit, like, anti-intellectual psychology, pop psychology is just, it's rampant through this movie, and it's just, and then you've got the Top of the Pop scene, which is just unnecessary. You've got the bad film language. You've got that, basically, the remake of the Live Aid performance, which is just basically, I mean, a pantomime. It's a 20-minute pantomime. You could go watch this same performance on YouTube. It's probably more powerful. I mean, you could listen to this. You could listen to Queen's greatest hits and get a far better effect than anything you get watching this movie. It's just not a very well-made movie, and it really just didn't need to be made based off of what I saw.
It's interesting because I've heard bad movie first and foremost out of the reviews, including yours. And that actually seems to be the thing that I'm worried about least, is the fact that it's a bad movie. I mean, as I mentioned, there were a couple of moments where I kind of cringed, but it was so few and far between. At the end, everyone in the crowd was in their seats through the credits. Like,
well, I should shut the fuck up then.
We can disagree. There's nothing.
No. In fact, I think I've kind of gone easier based on how much I disagreed with your article and all of the
critics. This point has come up repeatedly now where you know, everybody was happy, so why aren't you, Sean?
Well,
that's what it feels like. That's what it feels like.
That's not what's being said. It's more of a,
we're talking about it's a bad movie. I didn't feel it was a bad movie. What I stated was I had a different experience than you, and I'm not expecting you to be happy. In fact, I could have said you're wrong. I didn't say you're wrong. In fact, hell, you could be right. I could see this a second time and it could be completely shitty. I could know more about Queen in 4 years and rewatch this and say, Oh, well, that's not what happened. But every critic review that I read was an expert on Queen all of a sudden.
It's not about accuracy.
And the movie isn't... The movie itself is made with the blessing of band members. Okay, they're executive producers on this, too. It took forever to get to the screen. I have a hard time feeling like... What ended up on screen didn't get their okay. Whether or not that reflects Freddie Mercury, we're either basically saying then, we didn't like Freddie Mercury, and so we're going to portray him in a fashion that reflects better on us, or we loved him and we tried to be as honest as possible through the filmmakers and writer. They collaborated with the writer and Bryan Singer for some time. I was surprised to see Bryan Singer's name on the director credit, by the way, but it's just the rule from the Directors Guild that if they finished a film, his name has to be on there. But Dexter Fletcher is the one that actually finished the film. What's weird about this is that normally I kind of blow my top in my head when I read things where people disagree with me, and I've had this weird moment this week, maybe it's because of election stuff, where I've said to myself, they might have a point. Just try and hear it out, okay? And you're talking about film language. I haven't read the article about film language, and I don't know shit about film language. I'm a fan. We're on this, like, you know more about film language than I do, in all seriousness. I don't know about that. Because from a music technical aspect, you kind of get how artists work. I'm more of a, how do I experience these? How does it make me feel? And I know very little about the study of film, but I can tell you I felt very positive walking out of this. So it made me wonder, how are we experiencing this differently? And the only thing that I could come to a conclusion of was that critics had something that wasn't fulfilled. I had very little knowledge and saw a movie that I enjoyed.
I'm not projecting onto this movie. I'm not projecting my opinion of Freddie Mercury. I don't know Freddie Mercury. The way it came off to me, as it's put together as a movie, it came off to me like they treated his life as if he was completely miserable all the time. And he had absolutely no agency in who he was. Everybody pushed him in this direction or that direction. He has no personal, where he acts out as himself. Jim Prenter is portrayed as this, Paul Prenter, whatever his name is.
Paul.
He's portrayed as, okay, fine, it's Paul. Fuck. Should I just shut the fuck up? I'm sorry, I'm feeling a little bit fucked. Like, everybody's assuming my opinion here.
Well, nobody said anything directed at you at all.
50 words in my mouth.
The only thing you're doing, you are projecting what we're saying on you, which we are not doing. You are projecting
that. I specifically stated that I was having a moment of clarity that it's okay for people to have different opinions, and I'm wondering why I feel differently. And in fact, there's no harshness in my voice at all. So, by all means, continue.
I don't know what else I can say.
You don't like it. I like it. You're kind of expecting that it exists, and it may not have needed to, but it's
film. I'm not even disagreeing. I don't think it's necessarily a great movie. I think it is kind of sloppy. It does go all over the place, and there are eye-rolling moments, but I think it captures a greatest hits type thing and fun people for the casual fan. I've always been the guy that doesn't care about, you know, when we talk about, well, there's no one to like in the movie, so why would anybody enjoy it? I don't care about the rules, and it is a rock movie, so that they don't care about rules either. So I don't mind the fact that they aren't following, you know, film language. They aren't being true to the film language. It doesn't bother me. They're just doing what they want, and it wasn't what I was hoping. I thought maybe they were going to go for an Oscar-type movie. It's not. It's more of just a fun little... medley of their greatest hits.
You know what I'm kind of excited about, though, that my son, he's 12, so take a 12-year-old's opinion for what you will, but he said that it's his favorite movie of the year. And that's such a big deal to me to hear him say that over, say, a superhero film or your classic summer tent pole or whatnot or Fantastic Beasts or whatever the case may be. It means that he's engaged with the material and he engaged with this movie more than I expected him to, and it met his expectations, and he's been doing nothing but talking about it. And he learned like a little bit more about life as a result of this movie too. I felt it was very important to have a discussion with him about what it meant to have Freddie Mercury in this world and what he meant to people as I understood it. And in fact, what he died from meant and where that came from. And this is something that he had no knowledge of. And it was important for me to establish that with him for the first time in his life, for this to exist, to kind of provide a narrative of that is it's neat. I know that I'll remember it as a result of that. Like, I can like it and forget about it, whatever the case may be. But for him, it seems clear that it will stick.
Yeah, and I don't think it'll stick for me per se. It was just one of those where, oh, this was as bad as it. Like, I almost didn't go see it because I was running out of time. And the fact that Josh put something on Facebook about liking it, and I was like, oh, maybe I'll give it a shot.
Yeah, and three different people or so asked me, like, oh, we're going to need to know what you think about it. Well, first of all, don't ever come to me. Second of all, if you want to know, I'm going to just give something vague so that they can come up to my the show here.
All right, I may have to pause the show to get rid of a dog.
Yeah, be my
Ben. I'm enjoying this. I don't know what your problem is.
I'm miserable because I know he's going to start.
He's the
barking.
Best part of the show right now.
I wonder if this will continue. Our undisputed classic is Ray.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the main event for the linear, legitimate, and universally recognized undisputed classic.
Ray, starring Jamie Foxx as Ray Charles, directed by Taylor Hackford, telling the story, the life story of Ray Charles in a way that's okay, not great. It's good. The direction is good. What stands out about this movie is not so much the movie itself, which is serviceable. It's good enough. It does a lot of the other things I was talking about with the Queen movie, which is a lot of that assumed pop psychology kind of thing with the consistently really terrible flashbacks that they do in the movie. But beyond that, though, Jamie Foxx, I honestly believe this is one of the singular great performances by an actor in this young century. And I know that's hyperbolic, I get it, but I truly believe it. I was moved, I was engaged, it was so much, this performance was so meaningful and so brilliant, I can't deny the movie. Even as Taylor Hackford's hacky bullshit gets in the way sometimes, Jamie Foxx is so good, it doesn't matter. And Rami Malek almost gets to that point. If the script weren't so terrible in Bohemian Rhapsody, he could have probably made that movie much, much better than it is. Jamie Foxx at least is working with a much better script here, and he's so amazing at bringing it to life and bringing Ray Charles to life in the way that he does, that we feel like we're seeing the entirety of his life in this movie, just because Jamie Foxx feels so lived in, and his work is so incredibly believable. The music is so brilliantly weaved in, and that's the one thing I've got to give Hackford credit for, is the way he weaves in the music brilliantly, and the performances brilliantly, weaving them one into the other is really great. I could do without, like I said, the pop psychology flashback bullshit to when he was a child. It means something to his addiction, I get it, but it's a lot of assumed, you know, Freudian bullshit that comes out a lot. It's a simplistic screenwriting shorthand and a directorial shorthand that people use to try and explain somebody's trauma, and that is pretty played out. But as a performance, though, this performance is so powerful and so incredible that you cannot deny this movie.
This kind of goes with Bohemian Rhapsody and Ray and a lot of other movies, and it comes back to that Lord of the Rings conversation. I feel like for me, you know, the people who like to watch the 6-hour version of Lord of the Rings, they don't care if 3 hours doesn't mean anything. It's just, but they just like being in that universe, whatever. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think with these movies, I just like being in that. One, I'm an accountant by day, and then I like rock music, so it's a lot of it's business stuff. I've interviewed a lot of people, and I know how they get screwed. And I'm not saying I know more than I'm just, I like that part of the, I just like seeing all of that. So I just think I like being there and like these movies a little more than most do. Although this one was critically praised, one of the better ones. But you're right, Jamie Foxx is. And I think it helped that he went around, you know, the talk show circuit and stuff and sat down at a piano and did this stuff live. And, you know, you don't see anybody else do it. I mean, Bradley Cooper wasn't going out with the guitar playing songs on, you know, on the late night shows. And it wasn't, he was Ray Charles. I mean, I don't see Jamie Foxx when I watch that movie. It's not Eddie Murphy doing Stevie Wonder. It's, he has everything down and it's just so perfect. And
to a point where it really, it transcends mimicry.
Oh yeah. He was being used by like Kanye West put him in a rap song to redo a Ray. I mean, it's ridiculous, but that's how good he was in this. And I don't know. I just found myself enjoying every second of it with, I mean, I don't disagree with you on the flashback stuff, but I don't, because of the Wikipedia version, sometimes you just have to do stuff to make it easier, I guess. I don't know.
I guess film kind of requires that you have to have a reason for the way that they use heroin or something like that. And this is a movie now I've seen twice, and what you hit on there was something I hadn't realized till now. Living in the world of a film, be it Star Wars, be it Lord of the Rings, what have you, I love this movie because I love this music, and I knew a lot of Ray Charles going in, but not all of the stuff, not the country music that he was singing, not the opening stuff where he wasn't instantly a star. He spent a long time on the road with really shitty people for the most part and people taking advantage of him constantly. I found myself at the end of this movie, we're talking about 1 a.m. here last night, and I'm like, oh, that's it? And it's because it was 14 years apart watching it, finishing it up, thinking, oh my gosh, that went by so breezy for 2 hours and 20 minutes or whatever the case may have been. And there was an extra 25-minute extended edition that's on that disc as well that I didn't watch because I wanted to remember what I saw.
And it was the 1 a.m.
If you know me, though, and plus I had no idea that it was the daylight savings thing, so I could have bought myself that extra 25 minutes, no problem, but, and then woke up at 5:15.
That fucker ruined my daylight savings time. And I swear to God, I don't know how this works out, but I've had my niece babysat her probably on 4 out of the 7 daylight savings times of her life. So when she was like 2 or 3 at 4 a.m, Aunt Lindsay, I'm ready to get up. No, this isn't happening. Anyway, I apologize.
It's a good aside. But Jamie Foxx was, the reason I saw this was because of him. I had grown to really like him, not for his In Living Color stuff. I really came to him late. Any Given Sunday, I saw him in, you know, Bait. But there was one that he played with Morris Chestnut, and I can't remember the name of the damn movie, but I really enjoyed it. And I feel like we've mentioned it on the show before, well, and you liked it.
Weirdly enough, the reason that we mentioned that movie is, I think it's called It Takes Two, or
Two Can Play That
Two
Game.
Two Can Play That Game, that's it. And the reason we've ever brought that up is because it was the first movie I saw after September 11th.
Okay.
I saw it September 12th because I needed a break from CNN for like 2 hours. And I gotta say, I really enjoyed the movie.
And I did too. As it turns out, he's also in Bait, was, I think I already mentioned that one, is a throwaway movie. He's actually a lot of fun in that one. And I started to gravitate towards him as a performer. And then I saw this, and what you said about it transcends mimicry, there are certain scenes where I'm wondering if that was stock footage of Ray Charles or if it was Jamie Foxx, not just because he bears a slight resemblance to him, because he does from time to time, but also the way that he moves, the way that he articulates, his gyrations, his swayings, and everything like that. It's so much of what I know of Ray Charles that it's... Gosh, I mean... Your statement about Kanye West matters because when I listened to that song for the first time, I said, oh, really cool. Kanye's using Ray Charles stuff. And then I saw like the music video or whatever, and you see Jamie Foxx there mouthing those words. I'm like, why would Jamie? Wait, he was Ray in the movie. Of course. Okay.
They changed the words and everything.
So another insight into my ridiculous line, but I really like this movie as a classic, as we hold it to a certain standard. I don't know, maybe of the genre, maybe of musical biopics, it could be the best. I'll say that it's my favorite of the musical performance biopics.
Performance-wise, far and away, it's, I think, the best performance in a music or biopic type thing. I don't know.
I'd go further and say, like I said, I think it's one of the great performances, period, outside of genre. It's an incredible performance because it's not just that he's playing Ray Charles. He's playing, if Ray Charles didn't exist, this would be an amazing character. That's just how good Jamie Foxx is at bringing this person to life. And I will stand by this as much as I don't think that Jamie Foxx has proven himself out to be a great actor afterwards. I think he still has the potential based off of this. He can pull it out when he wants to. He just hasn't, and he hasn't got the chance or isn't finding the proper material to do it. But based off of this, I don't know why he isn't working every goddamn day on something amazing, you know? Because he's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, he's also a stand-up comedian here and there. And I mean, Collateral, he was okay in. I thought he was pretty good in that.
Oh, absolutely.
But you're right. I mean, he doesn't do that. You would think there'd be a Collateral every year.
Collateral, I think, may have come out like a couple months before Ray in 2004. Oh, really? That's the
same year?
Because the Collateral was like a July-August movie, I think, and Ray was like end September, October, November, something like that in 2004. But and the thing is, this movie turned Jamie Foxx into a destination actor for me. I would go see a movie just because he was in it.
Didn't he go and do a movie like Jessica Biel right after the Oscars? Sounds like really,
really
bad.
Are you talking really about bad. Not SWAT, but the Stealth movie.
Stealth. Yeah. Ooh.
Then they come out, that's really bad.
Wasn't that the first thing you did after winning the Oscar? So, yeah. I'm pretty sure like that month it came out.
Ooh, does that movie like that suck? Oh, man.
And that might be why he's not working as regularly. But I don't know. I think it really, it's that world. I just like being in those worlds. And I don't know. I like the creation of songs. You know, anybody who's ever written a song, it's kind of a magical experience. And when a movie can capture that, and I think Ray captures it better than Bohemian Rhapsody does. Bohemian Rhapsody mm-hmm. catches it okay. Sometimes you roll your eyes a little bit, but it's still, I think they both capture it to an extent. And I really like seeing that in movies. And but some of those scenes in Ray are phenomenal.
I agree with you. Any movie that has creation of music, for whatever reason, movies seem to provide such a wonderful arena to see that come to fruition. And I'm sure in real life, because I haven't done it myself before, I'm sure that it's very awkward and arduous and there's lots of arguing and lots of failure before it actually happens. But in a movie, your stories are so, you need to get to the point in a way that it makes it seem like such a delightful thing to do, to create music, and idealizes it for sure, but also inspires you to want to do it, I guess.
Have you ever seen Some Kind of Monster, the Metallica documentary?
No.
Oh, there is a scene where they're trying to get this, they have like a riff, but they can't get it to work, and they're just trying to come up with the lyrics and the melody and all, and then all of a sudden it just clicks, and they happen to be there capturing it, the documentary. And it's just like instant goosebumps. You see something like that happening. And I don't know. It's just really, it's like any fighting and all that arduous stuff you're talking about. As soon as it clicks, it's just like, oh my God, this is amazing.
It was totally worth it. Right. It reminds me of the scene in Once where Hansard or Glover are sitting at the piano and they kind of just figure it out. In this movie, Ray hearing things the way that he does, being able to pick out like, okay. And then he adapts to it. And I get goosebumps when I see geniuses like that do things just based off of what they're hearing.
There's a scene that reenacts something that Ray actually did and was capable of doing where they walk into a nightclub, and obviously Ray doesn't know who's performing, but he's able to identify that person on stage just from hearing the way that they played. And that is something that Ray could do throughout his life, and he would shock people by doing that.
That's some savant-level stuff right there. That's amazing.
I can kind of do it with guitar players if I know who they are. I mean, if I know.
You weren't a savant.
Well, I'm not. Well, I don't want to say them. I don't think it's as hard as you think it is. Like certain players just sound like, oh, that's Slash, or that's who, you know, you just know, no matter if they're playing with Michael Jackson or whatever, there's Eddie Van Halen.
It does take a level of expertise, though, and care. You have to care about it.
Well, then you have to know who people are, too, and that's the other thing Charles says more so than I do.
You also have to be able to hear it.
That is true. Put your top five. Who's your top five?
All right, our top five this week is concert films. Kind of because of the U2 movie in 1988, but then kind of these, although I don't think any of them are. Is Rattle the Hum a concert movie, or is it more of a documentary?
It's a concert movie, I think, based off of, I mean, you can't find it anywhere. What you can find is basically just a series of performance clips on YouTube.
So they are performing.
Yeah.
It's a chronicle film of their 1987 tour. The soundtrack itself, which at least I got to that. I listened to the entire soundtrack. It's all live performances in one way or another.
Oh, Cousin Jeff participated. He had Justin Bieber, Never Say Never. The BC Boys, awesome. I fucking shot that. Prince, Sign of the Times. Talking Heads, Stop Making Sense. And Madonna, Truth or Dare. This one was hard just because there's a lot of them out there. So I tried to just the ones I like the most, I guess. The Celebration Day movie that Led Zeppelin did when they all reunited and rehearsed forever, because their Live Aid performance, I don't know if you've ever seen that, one of the worst performances of all time. They didn't rehearse or anything. Phil Collins played drums. They just sucked. And that Queen show, they claim that to be the best rock performance in the history of live performances. That's kind of why I think that they're showing the reactions the way they did.
Oh, but okay. Well, still, in that case, that they didn't pull it off, because it did not indicate, based on their reactions, that they were experiencing something legendary. They were just like,
And they made it seem like he dies the next day, and there's still six more years, more albums, more stuff. Yes, anyway. Course. Woodstock, Gimme Shelter, the Rolling Stones movie. I actually like that better than the Martin Scorsese Stones movie. Through the Never, the Metallica movie. Yes, there's a lot of pointless cool shit in it, but it's for a performance, though. They had IMAX cameras like in the crowd. It was a pretty fantastic performance movie. And then Rock of the Rising Sun, Aerosmith, they went to Japan right after the tsunami there or whatever that hit back in 2010, 2011, and they were the first band to go there, and there's a little documentary that goes with it, and I'm a big Aerosmith fan, so Josh?
You know, it makes me wonder when you say that, and then I remember what happened with Live Aid, and of course the movie that talks about it. Every time that something happens that's catastrophic, if they can raise that kind of money just by playing music, like, we should do that every time. I mean, I know they did something after 2001 with the terrorist attacks and whatnot. I remember watching a good portion of it, and I know that it has happened for various causes, but boy, if everything happened and they could just get like £1 million or whatever it was that they got from that, that would be really cool. My list sucks. I mean, I haven't seen enough concert films. I was hoping to get Rattle and Hum in this week, but as Sean mentioned, it's not available anywhere for whatever reason. It's not even on their website to stream and pay for. Like, you would think that they would have it lined up, you know? But Michael Jackson's This Is It is probably the best one that I've seen. I know that it treats him a little too angelic at certain times, but the energy of the movie of the concert film or whatever is really fantastic. It captured everything that I like about Michael Jackson without having to go into everything else. And we all know it. Okay. But focusing on his music alone and the sadness of the fact that he passed, you know,
so it never actually got to be a concert.
What's that?
So it never actually got to be the concert.
Yeah. Which, you know, the movie's a lot, it's a lot of rehearsal stuff. That's what it really is. And he never got to that tour,
but it's very, I mean, all the circumstances that go with that, that makes it a really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And directed by, Kenny Ortega, I think it is. And is that the director of Dirty Dancing? Am I right about that? Or is that a guy
named remake?
The remake. Oh, you're right. Okay. I misquoted that earlier today then. That was not the director of Dirty Dancing. Okay. Led Zeppelin's song, The Remains the Same. Not because it's like fantastic or anything, but it makes me live in that world and I've seen it. So it's got to make the list. Zeppelin's one of my favorites.
It's a good But they just, they don't play it. That's some of their worst performances collaborated into one, and to the point where they got a bad reputation as a bad live band. I was like, well, we weren't really that bad.
You know, and I wonder, because I've seen some Zeppelin clips that have like, they have a lot more energy than The Song Remains the Same. And I'm like, why would, I've seen better stuff. Put the better stuff in here. But anyways, Pearl Jam's 20 isn't really a concert film per se, but there's concert stuff in it, and it's really a reflection of their career. So it's on the list. And The Killers Live from the Royal Albert Hall. The reason I'm including that one, not that it's per se a movie, but it is like the whole concert, and there's performances involved, and there's camera work and art and whatnot. It does play like a movie. When I looked up concert films, there were a lot of live acts, and I'm like, well, if that's the case, if we're going to include those in the best of lists from music websites, I'm going to throw The Killers in there, because I love that one. And I did, I didn't get to watch The Last Waltz this week, despite my best intentions. I ran out of time, father-in-law in town. You know how that goes. Okay, but also, I did listen to the entire soundtrack through work and in the car, and I opened myself up to what the band has done over the years. It's not necessarily my first brand of music, but excuse me, I do appreciate the energy of that particular soundtrack.
Yeah, I watched it. I like it okay. I just, they spent a lot of time on one guy instead of the whole band, and they do rely on a lot of special guests, but it's fine. Pearl Jam, Let's Play 2, you should check that out. I should have put that on my list because I was there.
I have seen the trailer for Let's Play 2, and a good friend of mine that took me to that Moline show has told me that he really loved it, but that I've seen one Pearl Jam documentary. You know what I'm
seen
saying?
Seen one, you've seen them all. Anyway, yeah. Sean, what do you got?
You know, mine's is kind of basically just a combination of your list and Cousin Jeff's list for the most part, but there'd be one difference that I would have on my list is one that I've always wanted to write about, but I never have taken the time to do it, and I need to do it at some point. It's Katy Perry's Part of Me, which... say what you will about Katy Perry's music, I kind of like some of it. I don't like all of it. This is a documentary concert film that captures the state of our culture in a way that no movie has, and it's so unintentional about it. It's so bizarre. Her life at the time when she's making this, she's divorcing Russell Brand. She's having the biggest tour in the world. She's one of the biggest stars in the world. And she's has this kind of lack of awareness of her place in the world that is completely fascinating. You're watching her perform these very sexual songs in front of a mostly child audience, and it captures the moment of our culture where it is just this bizarre amalgam of, like, people are watching her dance around with cupcakes on her boobs, but everybody's okay with it. Just like, not that you shouldn't be. It's just strange to find that place in our culture where everybody in agreement over a moment here, and it's like, really? This moment?
You mentioned that very documentary a while back on the show, and I know that I'll never be caught dead watching it, but it was interesting to hear.
The combination of popular culture, reality television, all of it coalescing around this one woman, it is like a flashpoint of our pure popular culture at that moment.
And you talk about the things that I like from these movies, it captures all that too, you know, having to deal with being famous and kind of being lonely, and it does kind of capture all of that as well, which it's surprisingly a pretty solid movie. Anything else before we move on? Yeah, the dog's biting my foot. It hurts really bad, but it's shutting him up.
Podcast mascot.
Get him, Javi.
number 18 in 1988. Squeezed and pulled and hurt my neck in 1988.
Squeezed and pulled and hurt your neck in
1988. I might as well start with U2's Rattle and Hum, just to breeze by it. It's a concert film that basically chronicles their 1987 U.S. tour, and I really enjoy U2, or at least I should say I used to enjoy them a whole lot more than I do now. Their last three albums have basically been unlistenable to me as a fan, and so that makes me yearn for the 1987-88 stuff that they were writing and all of their earlier stuff too, which I really like too. U2 is an interesting band. Some people think that they're very pompous and whatnot for good reason. Okay, they're a very polarizing band. Some would say they're, you know, a little too popular for their own good, and I just wanted to see this so that I could get an idea in 1987, 88, where they were at. But it's not available to watch unless you want to try and put some clips together from YouTube. And I can tell you that the soundtrack is fine. It doesn't offer any new revelations. The songs Desire and Angel of Harlem are both on that soundtrack, if you give a crap about that.
I love those songs, yeah. And I really wanted to see this. I love you, too. I love the weirdness and the contradictions and the pomposity and the grandeur of U2. I enjoy that. So
I like that they sound like nobody else, but at the same time sound like everybody else combined. I don't know. It's weird.
I understand what you're saying. I really do, believe it or not, because I've taken a lot of crap over the years for liking U2, and I've tried to explain it through stating, okay, it's Edge's guitar. Like, there's just a particular way that he plays it that I only hear that from U2, not anybody else. But then, since like 2001, I've heard it in Coldplay a little bit. I heard it in The Killers a little bit even, and U2's getting a little spread too thin, and I wish that they would make something meaningful again.
And I don't know, I've always been like, I like the songs okay, but I don't get it. I don't understand why they're the stadium act. But I guess it's probably originality more than anything else. But
it was an entertaining show the one time I did see them live. But anyways, that's that. Also, something we should push out of the way. I haven't seen it, but a movie called The Good Mother with Diane Keaton and Liam Neeson. It's directed by Leonard Nimoy, of all people, the guy that directed, you know, Three Men and a Little Baby and a couple Star Trek films. The story surrounds, like, Liam Neeson and Diane Keaton are married. Liam Neeson seems to be the stepfather, and Diane Keaton has her son, like, come sleep in bed with them, you know, or whatever. And then the father, the original father, makes a huge deal out of it when really there's not anything there. It's just how people raise their kids and what's right, what's wrong. It reminds me a little bit of the kind of paranoia around the film The Hunt that I talked about from a few years ago with Mads Mikkelsen, and the way that people can convolute ideas of making things sexual when they're not necessarily sexual. So I was interested in watching it, but I haven't seen it.
I've not seen it either, but it sounds hilarious.
Sounds terrible.
From the director of Three Men and a Little Baby comes The Good Mother. Anyways, okay.
The anti-co-sleeping movie. Mayim Bialik hates this movie.
No. Oh, I don't know what that reference is, but it still caught me as amusing.
The five people who watch TMZ understand.
Okay. another one is a callback to a Taylor Hackford movie called Everyone's All-American, or Everybody's All-American. It stars Dennis Quaid and Jessica Lange. Quaid is a former collegiate star quarterback that has to adjust to life after football. Okay, so it's the Ryan Leaf story, or anyone like Ryan Leaf that can't adjust.
This movie's about him using heroin and robbing banks?
Could be. Because I haven't seen it. I'm not sure. But if you know Taylor Hackford, as we have discussed, Ray is a good movie mainly based on the performances and the music and what we like out of Ray Charles. I'll reference another Taylor Hackford film to state why I wasn't incredibly excited about getting this one in, and that's An Officer and a Gentleman, which mm-hmm. I really, really dislike, but got a lot of notoriety because Louis Gossett Jr. won an Oscar for that movie, and the soundtrack is well known for its large ballads. So Taylor Hackford's a pretty conventional director most of the time, and I don't know if I ever want to see a football movie that he's done.
I would like to see The Life of Ryan Leaf, though.
Fair. Who would star in that one?
Ryan Leaf. He's still young. Clint Eastwood can direct it.
Is he incarcerated, though?
He was. He's not anymore. Fairly recently.
He's been a guest in the Jay Moore podcast not that long ago, which I don't listen to often, but I listen to that.
He's apparently, like, he tried to rob a bank, and he was on heroin. And
he went through a dark period.
Who hasn't been there?
It's a good trivia question. Who was drafted after Peyton Manning?
A lot of people.
Right. And most importantly, this week in 1988, turning 30 is John Carpenter's They Live. And when we first discussed this on the podcast, it was part of a tournament that we were doing in March. I think it was
Did it end up winning?
2015. Good question. I feel like Good Will Hunting won.
We did it a couple of years in a row, so I don't remember.
But I think what it did was advance far past what we expected, and right. Part of it was the voting that I contributed by watching it for the first time, and that was 3.5 years ago or so. My memory of that is so strong, being like a complete...
Like another one if you need...
Another one bites the dust. But my memory of it is so strong as being completely different than what I expected. And such a smart take, but also a kind of a B-movie ridiculous take on what our culture is. And the thing is, this is a 30-year-old movie, and it has such relevance now. I enjoyed watching what I did watch of it this time. And the reason I say what I did enjoy is because I stopped it about an hour in because my partner was not enjoying this movie at all, it seems. And to the point where I got frustrated watching it with partner because partner wasn't enjoying it. And you know how that can happen sometimes. You're really excited for somebody to see something. They're not pissing on it, but they're also not happy. And you can sense it in their body language. And I'm like, no, wait, this is fun. They fight for 6 minutes. It's fucking awesome. Awesome. It's WWF stuff, right? It's ridiculous. And I was trying to state, don't take this movie too seriously, but understand what it's doing, okay? And just enjoy it. And that message didn't seem to catch on. So I still love They Live, and I would love to watch it for the rest of my life.
I think the issue that you have is that it takes about 40 minutes before he gets the glasses on. And Indeed. Really, that's where the movie really kicks into another gear. It's good up until that point, though. And don't get me wrong, because I like this movie a lot. And I think this movie, and I also watched the 4K restoration of The Fog this week. This movie's make me hate Halloween that much, much more because John Carpenter is so really, really good. And, I think he's actually better than what he did in Halloween here and in The Fog. This movie is really clever. It's exceptionally well directed. He's so smart, and he's got a real big theme that he's going for, and I really dig what he does with this. And, you know, Roddy Piper is a very limited performer, and he really works around that very well. Keith David goes on from this to voice a bunch of WWE documentaries, so you can tell he must have been a really big fan of Roddy Piper.
It's a weird movie, though. I remember the first time I saw it, I didn't like it, and I think it might have been when we watched it for the tournament that I watched it again. I was like, this is amazing. And I think having that, you know, watching it with the glasses on the second time or whatever, it was just from a different perspective because it is a weird movie. Mm-hmm. It's not conventional by any stretch of the word. And it almost has to catch you by surprise because I get why people don't like it because it's not – I mean, I get why people don't like Big Trouble Little China. I get why people do. You know, it's for the same – probably the same reasons.
Yeah, it's weird that I don't like Big Trouble Little China, but like this. My
brother's a huge Kurt Russell fan, and you can kind of tell this was written for Kurt Russell. And I said, what would be better, Roddy Piper in Big Trouble Little China or Kurt Russell in They Live? And I kind of think Roddy Piper in Big Trouble Little China would be better because if you bring Kurt Russell to this, it gets more conventional. And you know, I think his limitations make this that much better. And you have a real actor in there. I don't know. I don't know. So what's your answer?
Having a real actor in that scene where he's doing suplexes on Keith David would not work.
Well, that wouldn't have happened.
Well, you know, that you do bring up a good point, though. I had forgotten that it takes a while to get into it a little bit. And then you add Carpenter's score, which is a little like slow gin country western, like, burr, burr, burr. Like it really kind of lulls you a little bit. And so I do get why someone might not like it. But boy, I was so excited to bring this, like, look at the irony, you know? And she's such a huge fan of Kurt Vonnegut. I was like, man, this is like right up your alley for commentary on society. You've got to see this. And maybe someday we'll try again because eventually we're going to own this one. And I'm just going to watch it a lot until she catches on.
Maybe she'll do a movie podcast and she'll have to watch it. And then she'll watch it like kind of like I did, and like, oh, this is actually pretty clever.
She's not dedicated enough to movies to have a movie podcast.
Boy,
I'm barely dedicated enough to be on this show. I don't get to
more
watch
dedicated
enough.
Dedicated than I am. I'm more dedicated to the music part of it. You'd think that we would be doing. All right, then. Next week, we have The Grinch That Stole Christmas, directed by Scott Mosier.
Ooh.
Girl in the Spider Web.
Yay.
And Overlord, which apparently is getting good critical reviews, according to the trailers, at least. therefore, our undisputed classic is it Volver? Is that how
Volver, it's yes.
And our top five is foreign films, and if you're in another country, non-American movies.
Yeah.
Is there a Motivar film that turns 30 this week?
Yeah, that was inspiration, yeah.
Okay.
I don't remember what it was, but
neither do I. But I remember watching the one that he had from 1986, La Ley de something, the Law of something, Law of Desire is mm-hmm. what it was called. And boy, that was an eye-opening experience. So I'm excited.
I knew Scott Mosier had to move to Italy for like 2 years to make The Grinch. So maybe that does that count as a foreign movie? But yeah, that's our show. I do want to thank our Patreon supporters. Here are Key Grip Levels, Jason Bryant and Charlie Messing. Our character actors, Cousin Jeff, Christina Cato, and Josh Paul.
I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Our special effects level, Sarah Ward and Corey from Ivy Envy.
May the Force be with you.
Our associate producer is Jason from New Mexico.
Everybody has to eat shaving cream once in a while.
And our movie stars are Uncle Jeff and Dave Sievers.
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
If you want to be a Patreon supporter, head over to ihatecritics.net/Patreon and get yourself a credit on the show and some merch and whatnot. It might take a year to get there, but it'll get there. And then, you know, tell your friends about the show. Help us grow. Subscribe wherever you listen to us. Write and review the show, and we'll read your reviews on the air. Otherwise, we'll see you next week. Stick around after the credits if you want to play Flick Chart with us.
That ought to do it. Thanks very much, Ray.
And we're the three best friends that anybody could have. We're the three best friends that anyone could have. We're the three best friends that anyone can have. And we'll never, ever, 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 ever leave each other. We're the best three friends that anybody could have. I mean the three best friends that anybody could have. The friends, the three best friends that anybody...
Wolf or the Deer Hunter?
Deer Hunter?
Yeah, Deer Hunter.
I wanted Wolf to be so good.
Oh, it was so terrible.
Because it was like right after Batman and...
Ugh. Unwatchable.
Chronicles of Narnia, Prince Caspian, and 30 Days of Night.
30 Days of Night, because Caspian put me to sleep.
Yeah, I haven't seen either of these. The first Chronicles put me to sleep, so I decided not to go after any others. I
kind of feel bad they didn't get to finish the... Because you would think that would have like a Lord of the Rings light audience behind it, because it was such a... They kind of came out at the same time.
Like the pure flicks Lord of the Rings.
But not even that. I mean, they did have that audience, but clearly not as dedicated. Maybe they didn't have Peter Jackson either. That could have been
part of
it. I'm going to
go out on a limb for the C.S. Lewis versus Tolkien crowd. The interesting dynamic between those two over time. Tolkien's stuff of entertainment is so much better than C.S. Lewis's stuff of entertainment, the results of their literature. And I was forced to read for a college course two C.S. Lewis books. It was the most boring shit I've ever read in my life. And I've read Tolkien. So that tells you that if you lived in that time, that was rough.
I went to Catholic school early on and we had to read like Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe and all that, which at the time I thought was amazing. And then I don't know. It's been a while. The Notebook or Coming to America?
Coming to America.
Agreed.
Yeah. Three guys take Coming to America over The Notebook. Surprise, surprise.
I do have The Notebook. I do like it, but...
Despicable Me or Shrek 2?
Despicable Me.
I'm going to take Shrek 2. The Despicable Me stuff is that has been more annoying than Shrek over time, so I'll take Shrek 2.
And I've always been a Shrek fan, so I will go with Shrek 2. Have to listen to other versions, other episodes of the podcast where I go into Shrek a little bit more detail, the stuffed animal and whatnot.
Yes, that's right.
Life is Beautiful or The Jungle Book, 1967.
Fishing with Gandhi.
Sean plays the Fishing with Gandhi card.
He's used his no whammy card. I will take Life is Beautiful, despite the fact that it hasn't aged well.
Godfather Part 2 or American History X?
Godfather.
Godfather.
I agree. I had to think about that. Not really. The internet was buffering. Hero or 12 Monkeys? 2002. Not
the Dustin Hoffman, no. Gina Davis thing.
And 12 Monkeys, you said?
Yes. 95, not the TV show.
12 Monkeys.
I will agree with that one.
A Christmas Story or Real Genius?
Which one's Christmas Story?
The classic movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Real Genius.
The one that's...
Real Genius.
Real Genius is in that group with feds and big business and the stuff that I was talking about last week where you've got, like, witty movies like that. Real Genius is amazing. Like, that's something from the 80s that going back to it was a real treat. So I'll take that one.
I'm not a Christmas Story fan.
No.
But a lot of people are.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't wait till we have to watch Oscar, the Stallone witty movie.
Is it really?
I think it's fun. I don't know. I don't.
My mom loved that movie so much.
I think, isn't that 1990, 91?
It's soon, like next year or two. And I remember, because I wanted to be a big Stallone fan because of Rocky. And so I just started collecting everything that got re-released at Walmart. And I was like, okay, I'll get this. That one's one of the better ones.
Okay.
Stand By Me or Predator?
Predator.
Yes! Best action movie of all time gets a victory.
I don't really have an opinion, so that's fine. Hellboy 2 or Gone in 60 Seconds?
I don't know. Gone in 60 Seconds is kind of fun bad, so I'll go with that one, I guess. Whereas Hellboy's kind of just, eh.
It's definitely an exercise in mediocrity. I will take Gone in 60 Seconds as well.
Hellboy is such a popular, like, it's, I don't, people love those two movies.
For whatever reason.
I don't get it.
I haven't watched them, so I can't really have an opinion, but The Chronicles of Riddick or Back to the Future 3?
Riddick.
I will also take Chronicles of Riddick. I'm so glad that somebody else likes that movie. It's so rare. You're literally the only person that I know that likes that movie. That
movie's awesome.
Yes, it is.
Air Force One or Up?
It's one of the great beheadings of all time.
I know. Character sorry. Named Dame Vako. What?
Up.
Sorry.
Up or Air Force One? Yeah. Gone in 60 Seconds or Boogie Nights?
Boogie Nights.
Boogie Nights.
Dogma or War of the Worlds 2005?
Dogma.
War of the Worlds. Sorry.
You I did lost. Watch Zack and Miri. We never got to talk about that on the podcast.
You're right. I love the shit out of that movie. That was fucking awesome.
Yes.
In all seriousness, we didn't get to a streaming challenge last week when we thought the week was going to be bereft, and I went ahead and was going to include that one in it. But what an absolute surprise. I mean, I enjoyed almost every minute of that movie. It's funny. It has an actual soul to it. And then specifically the scene where they get together, that's incredible. That's like... That's the best sex scene I've seen in a long time. And I'm not kidding. It's like that actually matters.
Yeah.
Most sex scenes don't even matter, and this is not gratuitous at all. It's all love, and that, it mattered to me. It surprised me.
Yeah, no, what I liked about that was because he was kind of trying to make a Judd Apatow movie based on the cast,
mm-hmm.
but when you watch it, it's super tight, as the Judd Apatow movie is not. There is fat out the front of every crevice in a Judd Apatow movie.
And I got my Jason Mewes penis out of it. So... That's what I was going for.
It's basically the making of Clerks. The cable guy and Amadeus.
Amadeus.
Dead Poet Society or Office Space?
Office Space.
I will also take Office Space.
I agree. The Winter Soldier or Police Academy?
Winter Soldier.
Best Marvel film still.
Casino or Oblivion?
I mean, Casino is kind of hard to watch. I'm certainly never going to watch it again, but Oblivion I barely remember. I guess Casino, just because it's Scorsese, I'm going to assume it's more artful. I don't know.
Yeah, honestly. I still haven't seen Casino. Of all of the films I've rented over time and borrowed from people, I have had Casino in my hands 4 different times, and I still haven't watched it. The arduousness of going through those 2 tapes, for whatever reason, has always been so daunting. I haven't gotten to it, so I haven't seen it, but whatever the other one was, I guess I'll have to choose.
I haven't seen the other one, so I guess Sean picked Casino. So yeah, there you go. 7 or Bridge of Spies?
7.
Braveheart or Superman Returns? Not that funny.
And Braveheart. You guys can have it.
I will take Braveheart as well.
Me too. Mad Max or Commando?
I don't really like Mad Max. I mean, you're talking about not Fury Road.
Right.
Yeah. Fury Road's a good movie. Mad Max, I don't think, is that great. What's the other option?
Commando.
Commando's not that great either. Commando.
I'm going to take Mad Max because of Commando's complete lack of delivery for me when we watched that when it turned 30. Oh, it was very, very
disappointing. I'm basing it on if I had to watch one or the other, I'd watch Commando because I didn't enjoy Mad Max.
Yeah, I think I'd go Mad Max as well. But I was underwhelming when we did do all the Mad Max movies. Fury Road's far and away the best and possibly the only good one.
Very true.
The Wizard of Oz or Dark City?
Dark City by an inch. I appreciate Wizard of Oz a lot.
If you'd asked me a long time ago, I probably said Wizard of Oz. Like, at the time I saw Dark City, I probably would have said Wizard of Oz, but over time, Dark City has grown on me, so that's what I'll choose.
I'll choose the Wizard of Oz just to be different. Plus, I feel like eventually when I watch Dark City, it's going to be bad because of the director.
No.
I thought when we watched it a couple years ago, or a year ago, whatever it was, that it was going to be bad, and it wasn't. I'm like, somehow it's going to show its flaws. It can't really be that good. The Evil Dead or Anger Management?
Evil Dead.
Fishing with guns.
Evil Dead. King Kong 05, Ghostbusters 2.
King Kong.
I've never seen it. Pearl Harbor or Fargo?
Fargo.
That was quick. Batman Returns or The Evil Dead?
Evil Dead.
Batman Returns.
Evil Dead. Cheaper by the Dozen or Jaws?
Jaws.
Every Jaws movie. Every fictional Jaws movie. Cheaper by the Dozen is one of my 20 least favorite films of all
Cheaper
time.
Cheaper by the Dozen so goddamn much.
They could combine the two and they all get eaten by Jaws. Only,
that would be the greatest movie.
They made 2 of them.
Oh, God.
No. It just
horrible nightmares.
Scrape the inside of my skull out so I don't have to see it again.
Which movie gave you more nightmares? better question. Are you more afraid to get in the ocean, or are you more afraid to have 12 kids?